Why turn to Bonaventure in a time of crisis? There are really two answers, depending on the kind of crisis we're talking about. Some crises are single historical events, and surely that's what we mean when we think about the word today. The crisis of the pandemic, or a war, or aggravated racial tensions. But there's also the sense of crisis as a perennial challenge, the way our thought or experience tends to go wrong, and how to correct it. I'll speak of the first, the sense of crisis as a single historical event, more briefly than the other. But to do this, it's necessary to know something about who Saint Bonaventure was. He was born Giovanni di Fidanza in Bagnoregio, Italy, probably in 1217. Some scholars say it was as late as 1221, but most would give the earlier date. He tells us that as a child, he had been saved from a serious illness by the intercession of St. Francis. St. Francis died in 1226. It's not clear whether this intercession was something that happened during the saint's lifetime or was by prayer to the saint. But in any case, Bonaventure attributes his healing to St. Francis. He began his studies at the University of Paris around 1235, beginning with philosophy and the liberal arts. He became a Franciscan 8 years later, taking the name Bonaventure, and began to study theology. He had several notable Franciscan teachers, most famous of which was Alexander of Hales, who commented of his student that, quote, "I do not see in him that Adam sinned," end quote. For his part, Bonaventure regarded Alexander as his father and made the interesting comment that it was a sign of the rightness of the Franciscan order that it mirrored the beginning of the church. Beginning with the very humble and unlearned, it grew to encompass the greatest minds. So as Christ first called the fishermen, and eventually we see the great minds joining the church, so too the Franciscan order, Francis's original companions living the life of poverty, were very humble, but eventually it drew people like Alexander of Hales. Beginning in 1248, Bonaventure taught at the University of Paris and wrote a number of his most famous works, a commentary on the Sentences of Peter Lombard, which was the classic textbook of theology of the day, several biblical commentaries, a couple of three series of disputed questions, his own Summa of Theology, which he called the Breviloquium, and a famous treatise called On Retracing the Arts to Theology, that is connecting all of human knowledge to theology. He was prevented for 2 years from taking a chair in theology at Paris because of opposition from the secular or the diocesan clergy. He wasn't alone in that fate. The same thing happened at the same time to a Dominican friar by the name of Thomas Aquinas. Both were eventually allowed to occupy their positions by papal mandate. But in the same year, Bonaventure was elected Minister General of the Franciscan Order. During his years as Minister General, he composed a number of short spiritual works, as well as sermons and writings for the Franciscan Order. Most famous of these are his Life of Francis, which he composed at the instruction of the general chapter of the Franciscans. There were many lives of Francis that were circulating in the order, and the Franciscans determined it necessary to have one authoritative account of Francis's life, and they commissioned Bonaventure to do this. He was so successful that they, when they received it, they mandated that all other lives of Francis should be removed. The other famous work from this period is the Itinerarium Mentis in Deum, the journey of the mind to God, or sometimes translated, the soul's journey into God. This is Bonaventure's most famous work. If you have read anything of him, it is probably this. I'll speak a little bit more about that later. Late in his life, beginning in 1268, he delivered three important series of lectures to the Franciscan community at the University of Paris. These were lectures just for the community. There was one series on the Ten Commandments, another on the gifts of the Holy Spirit, and the third and final one on the 6 days of creation. He never finished this last because he was made a cardinal and he was sent by the Pope to the Second Council of Lyon in 1274. Aquinas was also sent to this council. Aquinas died on the way to the council in March of that year. Bonaventure did attend the council, attended the first session, but died at the council in July of that year. He was named a doctor of the church by Pope Sixtus V in 1588. And ever since, he's been cited as one of the greatest figures of the theological tradition, generally mentioned along with Aquinas and Augustine. Interestingly, Pope Leo XIII, who is most famous in theological circles for his vivification of the study of Aquinas, really instituting the study of Aquinas in the church and the seminaries. Pope Leo XIII was very taken with Bonaventure as well, and in 1890 gave him the accolade Prince of Mystics. I'll speak a little bit more about Leo and the connection with Bonaventure in a moment. So it's worth turning to Bonaventure in times of historical crisis because he was a leader. Minister General of the Franciscan Order from 1257 to 1274, and so important that some have called him the second founder of the Franciscans. He had to face various serious crises during his career. First of all, was an attack on the mendicant way of life, the life of the Dominicans and Franciscans. This first wave of this occurred in the middle of the 1250s when he was at Paris. A theologian at Paris, William of Saint-Amour, published a work called On the Perils of the End Times, in which he described the Dominicans and Franciscans as the false prophets that were foretold to appear before the coming of the Antichrist. Bonaventure and Aquinas both responded to William. Bonaventure's reply was a little bit more direct, it was more prominent. There are many things one could say about it, but a couple of William's charges were that in preaching and hearing confessions, the friars were going against established church authority. They weren't in charge of a parish. They weren't part of a diocese. They were they're interlopers trying to connect with to minister to the people instead of the pastors, instead of the bishops. He also said that it's an evil and shameful thing to see healthy men begging for their food rather than working. Well, Bonaventure responded with a series of disputed questions on evangelical or gospel perfection. Now, one way he could have responded was to give a kind of legal response. William is saying it's illegitimate what the friars are doing. Bonaventure could have responded and said, the Pope has given us this authority, our orders are established, we have the right to do these things. He decided to go a different route. He gave a theological answer. These are questions on the evangelical councils: poverty, chastity, obedience, and a fourth on humility, which he described as the root of gospel perfection. A couple of points that he made counter to William. One was that the natural condition of the creature is one of poverty, because the creature is created from nothing. Every one of us, therefore, needs to have an inward disposition of poverty and humility. And this can helpfully be manifest in outward acts, such as the act of begging. The largest question of all of these has to do particularly with the question of whether the mendicants should beg. And he agrees with William, actually, that it is shameful and evil for men to beg because they're too lazy to work. But, he says, poverty can also involve the greatest imitation of Christ, for it involves humbling oneself, enkindling mercy in one's neighbor, and freeing oneself for the things of God by removing all concern for temporal things. He even sees it as especially appropriate for his age, when avarice is a prevalent temptation among Christians. So, in a nutshell, Bonaventure's response to this attack is that not only is the way of life of the friars legitimate, but it's a necessary and indeed preeminently important part of the church's mission. A second crisis he had to deal with was within his own order. An attack within the order by those who were enamored of the thought of the Benedictine abbot Joachim of Fiori. Joachim was a 12th century abbot who spoke about a division of history into three periods corresponding to the persons of the Trinity. So there was an age of the Father, an age of the Son, and an age of the Holy Spirit. Some of the Franciscans took this and ran with it and said that the mission of Francis and the Franciscans was to herald the coming of the age of the Spirit, a new age, a spiritual age. This would surpass the church of previous Christian history. Poverty would replace the trappings of wealth. The humility of the unlearned would replace the erudition of scholars. And the movement of the Spirit would replace the clerical order that was said to be established by Christ. Bonaventure was somewhat sympathetic, somewhat. He was sympathetic with the view of Francis as a transitional figure. He compared him to Elijah and John the Baptist, but he was opposed to any radical departure from the church. So he kind of squelched this, the real radical elements of this movement within the order as one of his first acts as minister general. And some years later, in his lectures on the 6 days of creation, he developed a theology of history that's both centered on Christ, so we never surpass the revelation in Christ, and decisively shaped by the figure of Francis, in whom the visage of Christ breaks out anew. Okay, those are two, as I say, historical crises, distinct challenges that Bonaventure faced. Now, the third actual crisis of the time with which Bonaventure had to deal was an attack on the unity of Christian thought by what we call rationalists at the University of Paris. That is, those whose philosophical speculations were at odds with the teaching of the faith. Now, this was a specific historical crisis. Aquinas dealt with this as well. But it leads us to the other kind, the kind of perennial crisis or the perennial danger in Christian life. Specifically, it raises the question of the relationship between faith and reason. A lot of attention has been given to this, particularly in the last century. It became known as the Bonaventurian question, or specifically, does Bonaventure have a philosophy, properly speaking, or does he not? Broadly speaking, the question concerns the relative autonomy of natural knowledge, but there are different ways to understand the question. I want to break this into three parts. The first way of looking at the question is epistemological. So here, the perspective is the question, is natural knowledge possible? In other words, is the knowledge of things from biology to geometry to metaphysics simply dependent on the light of faith, or is it possible within the natural light of reason? So are different disciplines, the sciences, the humanities, etc., are they properly autonomous? Bonaventure's basic answer is yes. And he stands with the whole Christian tradition in this. Now, the Augustinian tradition, of which he was certainly an heir, had made this a qualified yes. Because the Augustinian tradition was well aware that while you didn't absolutely need revelation to know some natural things, there could be such a thing as knowing how to plow a field correctly without the light of grace. Nevertheless, sin had a serious impact on the human being's ability to know. Right? Bonaventure, so for the Augustinian tradition, the only way of knowing these things with certitude is to know them in light of God's own knowledge of them. Now, Bonaventure's perspective is not quite that, though he does gesture in that direction. Bonaventure says that the truth of things lies in them, but it only lies perfectly in God. If we know things on the natural level accurately, it's because we have at the same time a natural orientation to the truth of those things as it exists in God. Okay, so if I'm looking at, you know, a tree, okay, the truth of that tree does lie within it, and I can receive that simply by perceiving it well and thinking about it well. But I would only know it properly with certitude. The only way I can do that is because my mind has a natural orientation to God's own knowledge of the tree. So I don't need to share God's knowledge exactly, but I need to be oriented toward it to know the natural thing properly. All right. The value of this, Bonaventure, as much as Aquinas, is an epistemological realist. Both believe that we have a reliable knowledge of things as they are. Their accounts of this differ somewhat, but the upshot is the same. A second perspective on this question of faith and reason. I would call this an ecclesiological perspective, perhaps, or perhaps a pedagogical perspective. The question is, how should philosophy or other natural knowledge play into the life of the Christian, or more specifically, into the life of the Franciscans? The basic question here is, should friars study at the university? Interestingly, St. Francis had already suggested an answer to this. St. Anthony of Padua, one of the early Franciscans, was famous as a preacher and a teacher of theology. The question was, is this a proper activity for a Franciscan? And we have a letter from Francis to Anthony in which he says, "It pleases me that you should teach theology, provided it does not extinguish the spirit of prayer and devotion." So the scholarly theological enterprise is good. Francis is telling Anthony he can engage in that, but he's warning about the danger that it will extinguish the spirit of prayer and devotion. Bonaventure expresses precisely this kind of sentiment in a magnificent way in his lectures on the 6 days of creation at the end of his career. These were lectures, as I said, given to the Franciscans who are studying at the university. These were Franciscans from all over Europe who had been sent there to study, to earn their doctorates in theology, to be sent back to their provinces and teach the friars there. So Bonaventure here is teaching the teachers. And interestingly, he doesn't do this by a series of arguments. He does it by presenting a vision. The 6 days of creation he presents as a series of six visions of understanding, beginning with the understanding informed by nature or written into nature. What does this philosophical kind of understanding look like? Then there's understanding lifted up in faith. What does that look like? Understanding taught by scripture. What do we learn from scripture? This is where he develops his theology of history. There's understanding exalted in contemplation. What is it that we see in this vision? The other two visions that he was going to talk about, he did not get time to work on because, as I said, he had to cut short this project. But the point is that he is presenting, again, this series of visions of Christian understanding and exhorting the friars to pursue this as their way of study. There's a famous passage in these lectures where he says, the passing from knowledge to wisdom is not guaranteed. A means must be placed in between, which is holiness. So the pursuit of knowledge is legitimate and understandable. It is supposed to lead to wisdom. And the means whereby it does this is holiness. Aquinas, faced with this same question, thought, what we need to do is get philosophical knowledge right. Okay, when these rationalists are bringing up disputes with between philosophy and the truth of the faith. Aquinas thinks we need to get the philosophy right. So Aquinas composes commentaries on Aristotle. Bonaventure never composes a commentary on Aristotle. He read Aristotle, he knew him, he used him, but he seems suspicious of a purely philosophical enterprise if it's removed from the proper ordering of knowledge. From nature through faith and scripture to contemplation and beyond. What is the value of this? The danger of severing the pursuit of knowledge from the whole of Christian devotion is, of course, a perennial concern in Christian thought. From Tertullian's "What Does Athens Have to Do with Jerusalem?" to the medieval complaints about students who are only interested in novelty, to Hanser's von Balthasar in the 20th century pleading for a theology done on one's knees. Bonaventure is not in the least suspicious of learning, but he never fails to point us to the integration of learning and a devotion to the following of Christ. The third aspect of the faith and reason question, I call the Franciscan aspect. And I say that because it's not typical of all Franciscans, but Bonaventure really learns it from Francis. And this is his insight about seeing God in things. In his Itinerarium Mentis Deum, he has reflections on seeing God through things and seeing God in things. Seeing God through the soul, seeing God in the soul. And so on. This is the difference, through and in. When he's talking about seeing God through, what he's saying is that when you look at things, and if you really understand what they are, you will see how they point to God. You know, not unlike Aquinas' sense of we come to the knowledge of the first cause by knowing something that is caused, the first mover by seeing motion. Okay? Bonaventure entirely agrees. This is seeing God through things, coming, reasoning from things or from the soul to God. Seeing God in things is different. This is based on a sense that everything bears an expression of God. God has expressed himself in everything. So when we see God in things, we are opening ourselves to God's self-manifestation, God's self-expression in those things. A key thing for Bonaventure here is his reflections on St. Francis's receiving the stigmata. This was the inspiration for the Itinerarium Mentis in Deum. He was at Mount Alverno thinking about the miracle of the six-winged seraph, crucified seraph that appeared to St. Francis, and thus he has the sense of what this means. He describes in another place that what happened in Francis's receiving of the stigmata was that he was so inflamed with love for the crucified that his body was softened like wax to receive the impress of the beloved. Right. So that's what's happened. If creation and God's revelation is a matter of his manifesting himself, expressing himself in things, then it is critically important that the Christian be attuned to that self-expression, essentially through grace, right? Being open to being raised to different levels, different depths of the perception of God's expression in things. Aquinas would point us to the substantial reality of the thing. Bonaventure would point us to the way it expresses God. Both of these are glorious visions of the relationship of God and the world. But if Bonaventure is right about how the person who grows in faith and holiness and conformity to Christ can see more deeply into things and have a real sense for God, then we clearly have to conclude that the holy person, the saint, is a criterion for our theology. We could summarize all these points among faith and reason under the rubric of wisdom, Bonaventure's doctrine of theological wisdom. It's the reflection of a medieval mind that is committed to the supremacy of wisdom over knowledge, but also the strict requirements of knowledge. It is the vision of a Christian who sees the relative autonomy of the created order, but also the transformed sense one can have of that order. And it's the vision of a mystic who knows that the highest knowledge of God lies in the luminous darkness, but that the same God has revealed himself in and through the world through his self-expression. The final point I want to make tonight has to do with the importance of Bonaventure perennially in the church. And if he's perennially important, he's going to be important in a time of crisis as well. And I would say that Bonaventure is critically important in the work of a Catholic ecclesial theology. That is, a theology that is essential to the church. Let me explain what I mean. First of all, look at Bonaventure in his own time. He's writing in the mid-13th century. We commonly associate that time with the work of Thomas Aquinas. But as a matter of fact, these decades, from roughly 1240 to 1280, saw a common theological project, particularly engaged in by the friars, Dominicans and Franciscans, and very much centered on the University of Paris. You have Bonaventure and Aquinas, you have Alexander of Hales, you have Albert the Great, Aquinas' teacher, all of them engaged in similar kind of projects. They're writing the same kinds of things frequently. Commentaries on scripture, commentaries on Peter Lombard's sentences, disputed questions, summas of theology. They share a philosophical and patristic heritage. They express a common ordering of theology. They ask common questions. Now, this didn't stop in 1280. Okay? This kind of common university project of theology continued for decades and centuries, but something changed in the late 13th century. More of a hardening of theology into distinct schools. And one anecdote that is very revealing from the time, we'll express this well. In 1278, a Franciscan theologian named William de la Mare took Aquinas' Summa Theologiae and composed a series of corrections for it. So basically, Aquinas was very sound and very good in thinking about these things, but he needed to be corrected in these ways. The Franciscans loved this, and they eventually mandated that Aquinas could be read by sufficiently advanced students so long as they had William's corrections in hand as well. The Dominicans referred to these corrections as the corruptions, and they started composing treatises that we called the Corrections of the Corruptions. We actually have, you know, a number of books with that title, right? Which is to say that the Franciscans and Dominicans are starting to see themselves as belonging to distinct schools at that time. That's less the case in the mid-13th century. There was more commonality of the project and creative ferment at that time. My proposal is that we ought to read these authors in light of each other. So often they ask the same or very similar questions, but they don't always give the same answers. Well, when they give different answers, why do they do so? If we see an insight in one theologian's thought, can we look to another and see if it is there as well or not? I can give some examples of that from my own reading. But let me turn to a more contemporary setting, because this is of interest not only to historical theologians. So I guess what I've just been saying is that, fine, you want to read Alexander, you want to read Aquinas, you want to read Albert, do so, read them in light of each other. You'll get a better perspective on what they're doing. But to turn to the contemporary scene, I want to begin in the 19th century with Leo XIII and the encyclical Aeterni Patris, which mandated the study of Thomism in seminaries and promoted the, quote, study of philosophy, which shall respond most fitly to the excellence of faith and at the same time be consonant with the dignity of human science, end quote. Leo was interested in a perennial Christian philosophy, and by implication, a perennial Christian theology as well. I mentioned that Leo had great regard for Bonaventure, given the accolade of Prince of Mystery. He even quotes, in Eterni Patris, he quotes Pope Sixtus V, who had named Bonaventure a doctor of the church, quotes him as holding up for the greatest honor, quote, two glorious doctors in particular, the angelic St. Thomas and the seraphic St. Bonaventure, end quote. We know of Leo's immense regard for Aquinas. I'm not in the least suggesting that his regard for Bonaventure was of the same level. But the point of the encyclical is that Christians need to have the best tool for understanding God's revelation and its implications. Leo found this in Aquinas, which frankly has led to arguments for decades about whether the philosophy of the church simply is Thomism. My contention is that Thomism is the best approximation we have to a perennial philosophy and theology. But our understanding of what that is will be enriched and sometimes corrected by other Christian thought. And one of the best candidates for dialogue with Thomism is, for the reasons I've already indicated, St. Bonaventure, Aquinas' contemporary and colleague in the attempt to give a fundamental synthesis of Christian thought. Thank you. I look forward to our discussion.
Well, Dr. Lanave, thanks so much for that very insightful contribution about St. Bonaventure. And we do have a number of questions popping up, but I'm going to jump the line and ask a question of my own, if I can dare to sort of take the host's prerogative. And the question simply is this. We're in a kind of unprecedented moment. Most of us are living through something that we've never experienced before, a global pandemic. Now there's a lot of civil unrest. We're trying to kind of make sense of all of that. Given what you know about St. Bonaventure and the kind of advice that he gives, a very kind of spiritual approach to theology and also his governance of the Franciscan order, what kind of advice do you think St. Bonaventure would give to us in a time like this about how to think about our spiritual lives, how to think about maybe the life of the mind, the life of a student or the life of a professor, in a time when there's widespread social unrest or pandemic or a great need for charitable outreach, that kind of thing?
Well, I think a couple of things to point out. One is that Bonaventure, for better or worse, did have a sense that he was living in the end times. Exactly what that means is subject to debate. But when he's presenting his theology of history, he doesn't hesitate to see the coming age as a kind of final age of the church. Does that mean he thought that the second coming of Christ was imminent? We don't need to say that, but he does have a sense of something apocalyptic happening. So he's aware that Christian history can be like that, and that one will. That at some point there is going to be such unrest, such upheaval, such strife over the gospel that it will probably be a presaging of the end times. Now, what is his counsel to people of his own day? It's not to act as if that time is coming. It's to be aware of what God is doing in this time. So Francis is extraordinarily important for Bonaventure. One of the very first academic conferences where I gave a talk on Bonaventure, it was a session on medieval theology, and the other paper that was being given was on Aquinas. And the first question that was posed to me after my presentation was, why do you think that Bonaventure made so much of Francis and Thomas didn't talk about Dominic? I'm not going to speak for the Dominicans on that point, but I do think that Bonaventure does see something distinctive, something new, something worth paying attention to in St. Francis. He sees the concreteness of that historical particular, the importance of that. So you want to take a lesson for a later age is that, again, we need to be aware of the movement of the spirit. We need to be aware of the new things that God is doing, right? I don't have any particular insight upon what he would say about a pandemic or civil unrest. He's a very calm personality. I can't say that. And he does think that the life of the mind is an extremely important part of Christian life, even in a time of crisis. But in a time of crisis, it's even more obvious how it has to be oriented towards contemplation, towards the deepest spiritual knowledge, and not simply a technical mastery of the things of the world.
Great. Well, thanks for answering that question. And now we have some time for some questions from our viewers. And the first question is from one of our viewers through YouTube. So Anna writes this. So Bonaventure is saying that no non-Christian can truly be a theologian. Is that correct? What about theologians who are nasty people, theologians who lack charity?
Very good question. It seems to be there's two parts to that. First, can only a Christian be a theologian? And in a sense, both Bonaventure and Aquinas are going to say yes, because their understanding of theology is that has to be based upon an actual, real apprehension of what God has revealed. So, I mean, you could postulate that there would be a theology based upon the flying spaghetti monster, but because that is fictitious, you don't really have a theology here. You have an ordered series of arguments, perhaps, but it's not really a theology. There's no knowledge being gained through this. So Bonaventure is unremarkable in that way. It just holds with the Christian tradition that if theology is to be understood in that way, it can only be done by a Christian. There's a slightly different perspective if you want to talk about theology as an academic discipline, but I won't go into that at the moment. Now, what about can the immoral person be a theologian? The answer is theology should be understood on a scale. There are some things that the immoral person can see clearly and other things that he cannot. Certainly, the more one is transformed by grace, the deeper one's insight will be. Now, actually, I think that Aquinas would probably say much the same thing. You know, you expect a kind of perception on the part of the saint that you don't on the part of the ordinary sinner. But Aquinas doesn't use that to guide his construction of theology so much as Bonaventure does. Bonaventure seems to have the sense that if you are deeply conformed to Christ, there are certain things about revelation that will just be apparent to you, and that you could therefore use as the basis for a theology that someone else could not. Does it mean that only the moral person can be a theologian? Not exactly. But it is a very, very undermined kind of theology.
Excellent. Well, we have now a question from Teresa Ryland, who's one of our Thomistic Institute students who's been studying theology here at the Dominican House of Study. She has a very learned question, but actually it's a very interesting question. She writes this. Many Thomists, for example, Etienne Gilson in the 20th century, have noted that Bonaventure's use of analogy is different from St. Thomas's use of analogy. So Bonaventure has an idea of analogy of conformity as opposed to Aquinas's analogy of proportion. But setting aside that terminology, she says, and there's a critique that Bonaventure therefore doesn't give enough credit to the integrity of nature in and of itself. So according to this critique of Bonaventure, it would go something like this. If you try to connect all of the human arts to theology, as you described Bonaventure as seeking to do, does that tend towards a kind of forgetting or even annihilation of God's creation in the name of piety. So, for example, she writes, Thomists might insist that theology ought to be aided by a robust philosophy, which has an integrity in and of itself as a science, so as to avoid theology becoming a kind of theologism, she writes, that deprives nature of reality and intelligibility. Okay, so that's a pretty sophisticated Thomistic critique, basically saying if you pay too much attention to theology and you don't give enough credit to the integrity of the natural world, does theology become kind of unstable? Do you end up losing sight of the marvelous harmony of God's creation? So your thoughts about that.
Well, let me first repeat a point that I made, the epistemological contribution that Bonaventure has on the question of faith and reason. He will agree that philosophy can be based in simply what is naturally knowable, right? Nature does have an integrity, and the human mind is able to know these things. He doesn't describe this as simply paying attention to things. He says we perceive, we receive them, but we understand them in light of our natural orientation to God's knowledge of them. That does not require grace. That natural orientation is there, right? It's just a description of how, in fact, we know things. So there's no loss of the integrity of nature here, right? Now, when Bonaventure speaks at length in different places about the connection of the arts of human knowledge to theology, for example, in the very first lecture on the 6 days of creation, he talks about Christ, the center of all knowledge. And he talks about Christ as the center of metaphysics, of physics, of mathematics, of logic, and so on. You look at that and you say, well, is he really saying that you have to be conformed to Christ in order to be a mathematician? He's not saying that. He goes on later in those lectures to lay out basically an Aristotelian understanding of what mathematics is, or physics, or metaphysics. So this natural knowledge is a real thing. There can be a natural virtue, and so on. So it has that integrity. But what he's saying is that all of this knowledge receives its perfection in God. It receives its perfection in Christ. And so knowing that, we have a better idea of what's being said in this natural knowledge. So I think it is easier to... I think it's easier for anyone operating with a strong Augustinian sense of the limitations of the human intellect to turn to theology as opposed to philosophy. At the same time, there are great Augustinian philosophers, and there's such a thing as a Bonaventurian philosophy as well. And Bonaventure does not go the full route of saying that we have to be transformed by grace. We have to see the truth of theology in order to know anything on the natural level. But we need to be aware of, to know it fully, to know it perfectly, we need to know the relationship of that philosophy and theology. The other thing to say is that, no, I forgot what I was going to say. I had a great extra point. And it'll come back to me.
Great. Well, let me move on to another question. We have a few questions from one of our viewers through YouTube, Ray Reyes. So I'm just going to pick the first of his questions. And it kind of raises a typical thing that one often, if you become familiar with the way people speak about Franciscan modes of theology and Dominican modes, or a Thomistic versus a Bonaventurian approach, something you often hear. So I'm asking for your comment on this kind of comparison, which is that a Bonaventurian approach might look at God via the will, a kind of primacy of the will, or a kind of Franciscan school approach, where good precedes truth, he asks, whereas it's sometimes said that Aquinas approaches God via the intellect, that is, an emphasis on truth as preceding the good. What would your comment be on that characterization, and which approach is preferred for sacred theology?
The description of the Franciscan school as centered on the will rather than on the intellect really dates more from Duns Scotus than from Bonaventure, though it arguably has its root in Bonaventure. Let me give an example of the way I see Bonaventure. And this has to do with a common description of a difference between Thomistic and Franciscan theology. That is theology a speculative enterprise or not? Now, one would suspect that if you want to say that Aquinas focuses on the true or the intellect as prior to the good, that he has no problem in saying that theology is speculative, which is exactly what he says. He says theology is speculative and practical, but it's primarily speculative. Bonaventure asks the same question. Is theology speculative or practical? They're both getting the question from Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics. Bonaventure's answer is that there are different kinds of sciences, different kinds of knowledge. One perfects the intellect simply itself, and that's the speculative. Another perfects the intellect as it is involved in work, or as it's extended to work, as it's doing something. This is a practical science. Then he says that there's a third kind of science, which is the perfection of the intellect as it is extended to love. So it's an affective science. Bonaventure says theology is an affective science. He is not alone in the 13th century in saying that. This is probably the most common way at the time of describing what theology is. Aquinas is really the outlier by saying that theology is speculative. Albert the Great said that theology is affective. Now, as a matter of fact, Aquinas doesn't even raise the possibility of the affective. So this is the kind of situation where I look at this and say, are these contemporaries of Aquinas simply considering something that he never considered? Or has he deliberately set this aside? Are they confusing the matter? What should we say about this? And I think that the way I understand Bonaventure, what he's saying is that the intellect, as it's perfect, as it is extended to love, is the intellect as it grows by its relation of love to that which it knows. So this is not particularly pertinent to a lot of kinds of knowledge. Okay, does a biologist love what he studies? Does an astronomer love what he studies? It seems a little confusing the term. The theologian should love what he studies, which is God's revelation in Jesus Christ. So as he grows in love of Christ, he then gives guidance on the reasoning, the intellectual activity that his theology engages in. So I don't see Bonaventure myself as simply voluntarist or talking about the primacy of the will over the intellect. There's much could be said on that point. But I see that his conception of the intellectual life includes this affective element that is really interestingly related to the speculative. Not for him, it's not exactly identical to it, but it is related to it. The question for me then is, do we find similar things in Aquinas? And I think you actually do. I think that for example, his many, many arguments from fittingness are arguments that are based upon the sense that one has of what one is talking about. Why did God become man? Why was it fitting for the second person of the Trinity to become human? His answer to that is all in terms of arguments from fittingness, which means that he has to have a sense for what is fitting and what is not. Well, what is that except a kind of attunement to, a relationship to, the truth that one knows? So I think there's something that you could relate to Bonaventure's sense of the affective with theology. Could say much more about that, but that's a difference I would see between qualification I would want to make, kind of difference between intellect and will in Aquinas and Bonaventure.
Our next question is from one of our viewers on Zoom. And so Bart Upart asks this, drawing on the beginning part of your talk. He writes, it seems like St. Francis was against his friars engaging deeply in theology. And as you said, history shows that the Franciscans departed from that original message of St. Francis. So how does one balance both a spirit of humility, which might be a kind of typical characteristic of St. Francis himself, while still acquiring knowledge? Or how can you acquire knowledge without falling into the snare of pride?
Good. There's one anecdote I think that is pertinent here. Etienne Gilson, in his book on the philosophy of Bonaventure, mentions that Bonaventure, at one point, gives a kind of summa of reasons not to lend books. So, you know, people lose them, or they come back and they're torn and defaced, so on. You don't have them at hand when you need them. So it's a wonderful catalog of reasons not to lend books. But there's the story of St. Francis, who once got his hands on a copy of the Gospels. And so that there would be no competition among his brethren, he divided it in page by page and gave each of them a single page. Okay? There does seem to be a difference in the kind of intellectual, scholastic endeavor, interest in Bonaventure, as opposed to what you find in Francis. But Bonaventure, interestingly, addresses the point about whether theology is too prideful an enterprise, something the Christian should not engage in. He asks this in the very systematic treatise he has on what theology is. And the question he's asking is, should theology have should theology be a matter of reasoning, or should it be a matter of exhortation and pious thought and so on? And he distinguishes between a study that's undertaken out of the vice of curiosity and the study that's taken under the virtue of studiousness. It's easy to see a spiritual giant of the faith warning people who follow him from just being involved in investigating the things of God in order to talk about them, out of just a spirit of curiosity. If you reach that high, you'll be crushed by the divine glory. But there is a virtuous way to do this, which is taking on the virtue of studiousness, which has different parts in it. Thomas loved to talk about this virtue. And it means essentially that if there is a steady application of oneself to this thing which one knows and loves, then the theological intellectual enterprise naturally happens. This is where we can see that it makes sense for Bonaventure that, you know, Alexander of Hales, this great thinker, is a Franciscan. That the spirit of devotion and piety is not at all harmed by the great intellectual effort here. So, you know, were some of Bonaventure's contemporary rightly suspicious of whether studying at the university was keeping with Francis's original vision? I think the only way you could look at that question is to say there was reason to be suspicious. So to justify it, you would have to think about the way in which it is, in fact, a development of the Franciscan vision. In fact, my own interest in Bonaventure comes from precisely this kind of dynamic. I was very interested when I began to work on my dissertation on the idea of a spiritual vision giving rise to a theology. You know, so a deep, pious, spiritual, contemplative vision, a way of life that might be had by a great founder of a religious order, let's say. Could that be followed by the work of a theologian, given a theological articulation of this? This is why I chose to work on Bonaventure, because the great example of this in Christian history is the relationship between Francis and Bonaventure. And from what I can see, Bonaventure is being utterly faithful to what he sees in Francis as the inspiration for his theological vision. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks very much, Dr. Lanave. We have time, I think, just for one final question, and it comes from Werner Zane through YouTube. He wants to know, just very straightforwardly, what would you recommend for someone who wants to get to know Bonaventure and Franciscan theology, particularly in terms of a reading recommendation? Where might a person start reading St. Bonaventure or learn how to enter into Franciscan theology?
I should have prepared a simple answer to that question. I did not. But I can say that there are certain works of Bonaventure that lend themselves to kind of a basic exploration of his thought. Certainly The Soul's Journey into God. If you've not read that, that's a magnificent text. One thing that the reader of Bonaventure has to be aware of is that it can be a really frustrating endeavor sometimes. You will get to the point where you just don't see the point of his constant division of things into threes and into sevens. And this was, I mentioned his lectures on the 6 days of creation. There's a wonderful translation of that text available from Franciscan Institute publications now. Previously, the only translation that was available was done around 1970. And the earlier translator has numerous footnotes in there where it seems like he's getting increasingly frustrated with what he calls Bonaventure's numerology. Okay. I have gotten to the point, and many people get to this point of Bonaventure, where this is not troublesome because there's a certain rhythm to it. And you really can look at what is he looking at as the reason for this distinction? Is there something that's essential to this division in three that he's making with respect to this topic? It's not necessarily going to be apparent on the first read. And it's something you've got to get used to in reading Bonaventure. But it's meaningful and it's there for a reason. So you're going to find that in any of his works. His Life of Francis is an extraordinary and accessible book. His short treatise on the retracing of the arts to theology, it says short, very manageable. It's a lot of fruit for reflection there. So those are some of his texts that I would point you to initially. As for secondary literature on Bonaventure, probably the best one that I can think of is Christopher Cullen's book, Bonaventure, published by Oxford University Press, covers both his philosophy and his theology, and it's helpful. It is a very helpful introduction to Bonaventure. There's a wonderful companion to Bonaventure put together by an international group of scholars. Came out about 8, 9, 10 years ago. It's probably a bit pricey for the beginner, but it's an excellent work. There is going to be a two-volume collection of essays on Bonaventure published by Franciscan Institute coming out of a conference that was held 3 years ago on the 8th centenary birth. It's not quite out yet, but it's almost to be published. Etienne Gilson's book on the philosophy of Bonaventure. If you've got a philosophical background, that's a marvelous book. Joseph Ratzinger's Theology of History in Bonaventure is a famous and very, very good book. So these are just some texts to look at. The other text of Bonaventure that I would encourage you to read is his Breviloquium. This is his own Summa of Theology. It doesn't look like Aquinas' Summa Theologiae. It's not in a disputed question format. He's not saying, here's the question, there's opinions on this side, opinions on this side, here's how I resolve it. He's saying, here's the topic, here's what we know, here's what we think about that. Read from the first principle of creation or the first principle of redemption. It's a relatively short summa. but it's very rewarding.